that competitive side that he brings is tremendous. And now I don't have to listen to it as a competitor, right? I don't have to listen to it as an opponent. I don't have to chirp back at him. I get this supported. If he's chirping, that means we're scoring points. So I love it.
Hello and welcome to Always College Football. I'm Greg McElroy. It is March 11th, and we appreciate you coming to us from wherever it is you're coming to us from. Whether that's on the Spotify or Apple podcast platforms, it's awesome. If you're here with us via the ESPN YouTube channel, that's terrific as well. Along with me, as always, Mark Kubiak, Jack Foster, and Jake Garcia. I laid out a week ago what the scheduling model should look like in college football and how we should take good versus good and create a non-conference celebratory kickoff. And I think we're going to put that into practice today. So I explained exactly how it should look. And if you missed it, go back and check out the show from last week. You can take a peek, talk a little bit about how we should do our non-conference scheduling. And then today I'm going to lay out exactly what week one would look like in the event in which we put that scheduling practice into the reality of our scheduling model. We also are going to be joined by Marcus Freeman, who's the head coach at Notre Dame. They have a great week one game against Texas A&M, I might add, but they're in a great spot to potentially secure a playoff berth here in year three under Coach Freeman. So we look forward to our visit with him. So without much further ado, let's dive in. He's the head coach of Notre Dame. It's Marcus Freeman. He's back with us again. It is year three for Marcus Freeman in South Bend, Indiana. Coach, thanks again for the time today, my friend. Year three, it feels like it's gone by really quickly, but what would you say is different about this spring than maybe your springs in the past, given the fact that it's starting to become very familiar for you?
Yeah, man, you talk about gone quickly. I remember when I was at Cincinnati, we were doing these Zooms, and that's all you're talking about 4, 5, 6 years ago. And how fast time goes. But, you know, I think every year you learn something new, right? And you know, you look at year one and you're just trying to figure this thing out. There's no playbook, no game plan. And then you go to year two, how do I get better from year one? And it's the same thing as going to year three. My focus right now for myself and our entire program is to be the best version of ourselves, right? And that I think what I learned in the first 2 years is that as a head coach, you can get in the habit of just going through your routine. And, okay, it's spring ball. Here's what we do for spring ball, okay? It's fall camp. Instead of truly challenging yourself as an individual to be the best version of yourself, which is going to make you a better head coach and a better leader. And so that's kind of the mindset I've had. I'm excited for this spring. We had our first practice on Thursday, and we're giving our guys spring break. We'll come back, and we'll really get rolling for the next 14. But I'm excited and for this opportunity.
Now, you guys always do that. Do you coaches make that first practice before spring break, and then you get 9 days to think about whether or not you had a good day that day? Like, I don't know why y'all do that. Like, you played. Why are you doing that to us?
There's some things when you become a head coach that you got to do for compliance. And, okay, if you start spring ball here, it gives you longer meetings, and it right. counts these days in spring break. So we don't always tell our players why we're doing it, but there's a strategic reason for why we're doing it. I promise you that.
I can assure you there's no stone left unturned. I know it's for good reason, but I never liked it. As long as the record states that it was not fun having to do that one practice before you have like 10 days off. But look, year three at Notre Dame's kind of unusually historical. If you look at what happened with Frank Leahy, Eric Parsegian, Dan Devine, Lou Holtz, won national championships in their third year. Brian Kelly got to a national championship in his third year. Something about like that breakthrough that seems to happen in year three. And I know you're not super focused on the historical element of it, but do you feel like year three is kind of the year that you start to really have your fingerprints on the program and kind of where you want it to go?
I do. I think the things you learn from year one and two could have a tremendous impact on the way you lead in year three, right? And that where your focus is, what really needs your attention. And every day it changes, Greg. Every day it's, you know, maybe it's support staff, maybe it's recruiting, and what part of your program needs your focus is so important to make sure that there's no part of this football program that starts to slip. And so, you know what, I'm excited with this new group. Every year you start over, right? In January, you start over with this new group, and you got freshmen, you got a couple of transfers, you got new coaches, and you start building this group to make sure you're as close to your full potential as you go into week one of the season. So I'm excited. I'm optimistic, as any coach would be before the season starts, but I'm eager, man, to do it with this group.
I would imagine so. And I know you got to be eager to see what Mike Denbrock's going to bring to your offense. Look, I love Jared. I couldn't be more excited for Jared and the opportunity he has at Troy now. But when you go out and get a guy like Mike Denbrock to come back to South Bend after what he did the last couple of years with Jaden Daniels, knowing that the progression for Jaden Daniels might look a little bit like the progression that you'd hope to see from Riley Leonard, knowing that you were able to bring in a guy that with that much experience and that much success and that many skins on the wall, you know, how huge was that for you guys this offseason?
I think it was incredibly important. You know, not only has he had the success he's had the past few years as an offensive coordinator, the ability for me to already trust him because we worked together for 4 years at Cincinnati, to know the mind, the competitor, the person he is, him and his family that are coming up here to South Bend, it's tremendous for me. I feel as confident as I ever have in that offensive room in terms of the camaraderie, the stability, and what the productivity is going to be when it's on the field. So that was a huge win for myself in this football program. And, you know, we had a great first practice. He started chirping already at the defense a little bit, and I loved it, right? That competitive side that he brings is tremendous. And now I don't have to listen to it as a competitor, right? I don't have to listen to it as an opponent. I don't have to chirp back at him. I get the support. If he's chirping, that means we're scoring points. So I love it.
That's terrific. I would imagine, yeah, he's a fun guy to be around. So I would think that the interaction between y'all two, both on the practice field and behind closed doors, is probably pretty unique. With Riley Leonard, look, I know he had the ankle injury last year, had the tightrope procedure early on. By all accounts, he's good to go moving forward. But what's a reasonable expectation for him as he takes on these first 15 practices at Notre Dame?
You know, my conversation with Riley is to focus on you. And, you know, we've had meetings on his leadership and, hey, how do I do this better? And it's like, Riley, for the 15 practices, man, I don't want you to worry about that. I want you to worry about becoming the best version of Riley Leonard, because that's going to make you a better leader, a better quarterback, and our offense better. And so it's hard when you come in to a place that has guys that have been here and you're used to being just the most dominant player when you were at your previous program. Like, you're going to have to be on this bumpy road, is what we call it, to get back to where you were. But if you just focus on yourself and your self-improvement, I can't wait to see what his future holds, man. And you know, as a quarterback, you want to just start being a best leader and get this whole group going. That's not what these 15 practices are for, man. This is for Riley Leonard, for using him specifically, to just improve at the craft, improve at learning the offense, and improve at what we need out of him here in 15 practices.
Yeah, it'd be hard to, I feel like too, and I know it's a different era than when you and I played, like to go in and to be the new guy and then to be the leader is kind of a difficult thing to juggle. You kind of need time on your side to develop those relationships to appropriately lead. So is that accurate now? And look, we can talk specifically about Riley and his leadership style, but I feel like to me, it'd be hard to go in there and say, all right, hey, JD Bertrand, like, hey, that's great. Appreciate you. But like, I'm the leader now. Like, I don't see it working that way. So how does that kind of work nowadays?
You're right. And the way you earn the respect and the trust from your teammates is to be the best version of yourself. And I think you just hit it. Like, we don't need you to come in here and be Mr. Rah-Rah and get everybody going. We just need you to be the best version of you. And if that means that, right, Leonard, for you, it's to get the guys going, that's who you are naturally, then do it. But for me, to focus on that takes away from your individualized improvement. And that's what I want him to do, is just focus on being the best Riley Leonard that he can be. And how can he be the better quarterback and be better at whatever he's asked to do? And then the rest of those things that you just brought up will happen over time.
Yeah, I think they will for sure. And coach, I look at the receiver group, and I know there have been a few new faces that have turned over there. Lose a couple young guys that I knew you had high hopes for, but you brought in a couple guys, some veteran guys. But that's kind of been the position group that it's like, okay, when will we take that big step? You know, and I know there's some young players that you're very excited about on that roster, but it does feel like that's a group that collectively can improve a little bit heading into this season. So What's a reasonable expectation for growth for them throughout spring? And then what can we hope to see from them in the summer and fall camp and, of course, in the fall?
Yeah, I've been extremely pleased. Just the growth that they've made in these first couple months. With the new guys that we brought in, you know, we still got guys that aren't even here yet. Jordan Faison is still playing. He's really full-time lacrosse right now and supplementing
He'll be all right. I'm not worried about Faison. We've seen enough from him. Like, he's one of those, like, freakishly good athletes. Like, he'll be all right. He'll be in the slot. Yeah. We know he'll be fine, whether he's on the lacrosse field or not.
Exactly. You know, and so it's really good just to see, you know, Chris Mitchell's a transfer that's come in here. Jaden Harrison is another one that came in. The depth is improved. And which is making everyone that's been here better, right? You're not asked to be the guy that goes out and gives and runs 30 plays in a row and expected to win every single one. And so I'm excited. I love what Coach Mike Brown, our new wide receiver coach, has brought into this room. And when everybody gets here in full strength starting in the summer, this is going to be a good group. I think the best that I've had since I've been here.
Yeah, that's excellent. Really, really exciting to know that group collectively is moving along. Look, I hate to see, you know, Chris Tyree leave, Holden Stays leave, but you did fill up with some adequate pieces, Bo Collins, Jaden Harrison, a few other guys. Looking at some of the guys up front defensively, look, it's nice to start with Riley and Howard Cross. Like, that's a good starting point. We know that. But edges, I know, is something that is of the utmost importance, and you lose a couple pieces there. You bring in RJ Oben, which is big, but how do you feel about the edges of your defense going into this upcoming year?
Yeah, I love, you know, RJ Oben's been a huge addition in the short time he's been here. You know, he's going to make an impact on this defense. And then what you also love to see on these edges is the development. Like, you can't just go and just count on plucking guys out of a portal to help your team reach its full potential. The development, Josh Burnham, who's playing our field end right now behind RJ, is giving us some depth there. You know, Jordan Botello's back at the Viper position, which is our boundary end. Bubakar Treu is another guy. And you'll see, I mean, just the depth now starting to trickle in and hopefully recruiting take over. And so I love what I'm starting to see out of this defensive line, the depth. We got some great battles that we get to make sure we see throughout the spring. But I feel really good, especially about the edges. And then we got to create some depth behind those tackles that you mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. You can't just play an entire game with two tackles in an entire season expecting those two tackles not to get hurt. It's a great buffer for now into the future, but we got to get some depth at those tackles positions.
Yeah, but I look at just some of the depth, though, that you've had kind of across the board, even the back end. I mean, you're adding Rod Hurd from Northwestern. Like, that's a big add. Like, you got depth in the secondary. Obviously, Xavier Watts is back, but Jordan Clark coming over from Arizona State. Like, I feel like you've done a really good job of forecasting being thin, you know? So you've kind of fortified and maybe accelerated development for other guys at other spots. So all in all, like, depth-wise across the board defensively, are you where you want to be?
Yeah, I think we still want to get a little bit more depth at the defensive back position, right? Mm-hmm. We got a great cornerback battle between Jaden Mickey and Christian Gray at our field corner. You know, you got Jordan Clark, as you said, who I feel really good about. Who's going to be the next safety? Because Rod Hurd is not here right now. He's still finishing up. He's not practicing right now. He's still finishing up school at Northwestern. Who's going to be your next group of safeties? Who's backing up Benjamin Morrison? You know, there's still some depth in the back end that we can continue to finalize. And then our linebacker, you got Jack Kaiser, the only one returning. I feel good about the guys that we have in that room. But until you have that game experience, you know, there's still some questions on how are you going to perform when the lights are on. And those are things that we got to get answered.
Yeah, well, as a quarterback, I've seen number three, Snead. I think he could play. I think he could be all right at linebacker for sure. You got some talent at that position. Finally, Coach, looking at the schedule, and I know you take it one game at a time, so you're going to talk about A&M right now. I get that. But that is one of just a couple of true road games that you're going to be playing this year. Now, the road gave you some fits a little bit last year at Clemson, at Louisville. Is there anything that you've adjusted in your process over the course of the spring to maybe make sure that you play at your best when you are in those hostile environments?
Absolutely. I look at everything in terms of what time we leave, in terms of what are we doing the night before, what are we doing the day of, the morning of. And so those are discussions I've had with our high sports performance team, that we've looked at some different ways to ultimately get them to perform when it matters, right? But I also told them, like, the other part of my challenge, like, I'm challenging myself to make sure that I'm structuring things in a way that's going to physically and mentally help you all feel the best you can when we're on the road and it's game time. At some point, you got to make the decision to go perform. Right? At some point, it can't be a rah-rah speech. It can't be somebody else getting you ready. You have to perform. And so it's a challenge we all have. I'm going to look at myself, but I want them to look at themselves too and say, okay, what do I need to do to make sure when the foot hits the ball, I'm ready to go? And I don't want anybody making excuses, right? I don't want somebody to make excuses for me as well as I don't want our kids making excuses for it. So let's all own this thing and let's all make sure that whenever we're on the road, which we've had two losses last year, which can't happen, we got to make sure we correct those things and that we're ready to roll.
No, I know you will be, Coach. You guys done a good job last year. I mean, I thought there was a lot of growth last year from year one to year two, and I really believe that there's going to be a lot of growth made this year as well. We appreciate the time. And lastly, look, I know you are on spring break right now, and I know it looks like you're in a gym. It looks like, like you got a bar on your back at some point, just a couple minutes before you hopped on this interview, but you're going to lift up that curtain behind you and it's going to be the beach or something, right? Like, you're getting away for spring break, are you not?
I wish I could, man, but with six kids in school, you know what? Listen, my spring break's going to be in this office actually unbothered. You know what I mean? A lot of times when the other coaches and players are around, you don't get a lot of time to get work done. So this is going to be time for Marcus Freeman to really take care of some things that he has to take care of without being interrupted. So that's my spring break. This wall is going to be here for permanently. At some point, hopefully I can get to some water. You know what I mean? Like, water is just good for your mind, man.
Yeah.
At some point, I need to be able to go do that.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You've earned it, Coach. Well, we appreciate the time. Best of luck finishing out spring healthy, making the progress that you want to make, and we can't wait to see you this summer and in fall camp.
I appreciate you, Greg, man. It's always good to see you, brother.
Always good, Coach. Thanks again. Well, Marcus Freeman and Notre Dame, they do a great job of playing a big-time opponent for the most part in week one. Now, last year they played Navy in week zero, but that was still a marquee event. Week zero has given us some good ones. We've seen Northwestern Nebraska in 2022. We saw Navy Notre Dame last year. We saw San Jose State and USC in 2023. This year is no different. Week zero, you're going to have Florida State and Georgia Tech live from Dublin. So I do think that week zero has been excellent, but week one has slipped a little bit of late. Just a little bit. And we need to lead our season with massive matchups. I mean, I'm talking blow it out of the water, biggest possible weekend that we can possibly create. And we've kind of gone away from that a little bit. I look back at 2016, and that was kind of the best week one slate that I could find in recent history. Here's just a few of the games that we saw that weekend. You had Oregon State at Minnesota. You had Kansas State at number 8 Stanford. You had number 20 SC against number 1 Alabama. You had number 2 Clemson on the road at Auburn. You had number 3 Oklahoma in a neutral site against Houston, who was number 15 at the time. You had LSU playing at Lambeau Field against Wisconsin. You had number 16 UCLA against A&M. In College Station, 18 Georgia at North Carolina, number 10 Notre Dame played at Texas, and number 11 Ole Miss played at number 4 Florida State. Like, those games are the games I want to see on week one. See how many ranked versus ranked matchups? You see how many great games that were both neutral site and true road games there in 2016? Those weren't all the games, by the way. Those are just a handful of the more marquee games. Well, now, fast forward to 2024, and it's kind of slipped. Let's just be real. Now, we actually have more Power 5 teams, P4 teams, I guess, if you will. 16 in the Big 12, 17 in the ACC, 16 in the SEC, 18 in the Big 10, plus Notre Dame. But there's only nine games involving Power 4 teams this year. Nine. That means there are 50 teams in the Power 4 that are playing either G5 or FCS teams in week number one. Is that good for the overall health of the sport? I don't think it's great. Now, kudos needs to be given to the SEC and the ACC. They play five games against the Power Four. The Big Ten is playing three Power Four versus Power Four games, and the Big 12, not so good. Big 12 expected to get two automatic berths here in 2025, potentially, or 2026. And yet your two Power Four versus Power Four games are TCU at Stanford and Penn State at West Virginia. It's not good enough. That's not good enough. And you look at the rest of the Big 12 schedule, it's like, goodness gracious alive. A lot of the games are just flat out unwatchable. So I put together some of the top games for week one this year. At number eight, TCU at Stanford. Does that game do a lot for you? It does for me to an extent. But it's not amazing by any stretch of the imagination. You got North Carolina at Minnesota. That's at number seven. Here's the number six mess around, find out game. North Dakota State is taking on Colorado. That'll be there in Boulder. Be careful with that one, Colorado. Now, you should win it. But still, be careful with North Dakota State. We've seen what happens when North Dakota State plays FBS opponents in the past. It wouldn't be surprising North Dakota State came in there with their lunch pail and made it very interesting for the Buffaloes. At number five, Penn State at West Virginia. Number four, Miami at Florida. That should be a very intriguing game, one that could be huge for Billy Napier at home if he can knock off a team that might be, well, in all likelihood, will be ranked in the top 25 in Miami. Number three, Notre Dame is at Texas A&M. Number two, LSU is at USC, and then the best game on week one next year is Georgia-Clemson. That game is going to be played there in Atlanta in a neutral site. LSU-USC, that game will be Sunday, by the way. That will be in Las Vegas. So, under my scheduling plan, now the scheduling plan that I came up with a couple weeks ago, and I laid it out last week, if you win your league, you play the winner of an opposing league in the non-conference. You'll play a round robin against the other Power Four champions if you win your league. So, under my scheduling plan, here's what week one would look like. We would start with the SEC against the Big Ten. Alabama would be on the road at Michigan. Ohio State would be on the road at Texas. Georgia would be on the road at Washington. Oregon would be on the road at Missouri. Ole Miss on the road at Iowa. LSU is on the road at Penn State. Northwestern is on the road at Oklahoma. Tennessee is at Wisconsin. USC is at Texas A&M. Kentucky at UCLA. Maryland at Florida. Nebraska at Auburn. South Carolina at Purdue. Illinois at Mississippi State. Arkansas at Minnesota. And Rutgers at Vanderbilt. Now, Michigan State was a team that finished 17th in their conference record last year in the Big Ten, so therefore they would play the 17th ranked team from the ACC. That would be the Wake Forest Demon Deacons, and Liberty would get to host Indiana, the team that finished dead last in the Big Ten. That's how it would look in the SEC and the Big Ten in week one. Reminder, I don't need to go through every single level again, but if you're finished eighth in the league based on record, a la Tennessee, you would play at Wisconsin. If you won your league, you'd have Bama at Michigan. Be amazing, right? Well, in week one, we'd also do the Big 12 against the ACC, which would fit them like this. Arizona, the number one ranked team in the Big 12 based on their record last year in conference. They were 7-2 in the Pac-12, which is slightly better than that of Oklahoma State's record in the Big 12. Arizona would be at Florida State. Louisville would be at Oklahoma State. Iowa State would be at NC State. SMU, welcome to the P4 SMU. You would be at Kansas State. West Virginia is at Georgia Tech. Virginia Tech is at Utah. Texas Tech is at Clemson. You're going to say, wait, hang on a second. Clemson, number seven in the ACC? Yeah, they went 4-4 in the league last year. Now, they finished really strong, and they finished in the top 20. So it's a tough spot for Texas Tech. But based on league record, that's where Clemson finished up last year, right there in the middle of the league at 4-4. North Carolina's at Kansas. UCF is at Duke, Cal is at TCU, Houston's at Miami, Boston College is at Baylor, Arizona State's at Syracuse, Stanford is at BYU, Virginia is at Cincinnati, and Colorado is at Pitt. I already referenced Wake Forest. They would play Michigan State. They're the holdover, the 17th team there in the ACC. They would play the 17th team from the Big Ten, which is Michigan State. This is a lot of information to take into account right here, right? I just listed off a bunch of games, a whole bunch of games. Gave you about, 30 games, 32 games to take into account in some of these matchups, and it's a lot. I understand that. But think about the matchups that we would receive if we were to put the scheduling model into place, as opposed to 50 FBS versus FCS / G5 program matchups. We actually get like versus like schedules and resumes, and you get highly ranked teams playing against each other that could help in coordinating the conference supremacy conversation the rest of the year. I'll start over just one more time. You're going to get Bama at Michigan. You got Ohio State at Georgia. You got Arizona at Florida State. You got Louisville at Oklahoma State. You got all these incredible games. Like, this is what we could have if we were to get rid of the non-conference scheduling the way it's been done for the last 100 years, and we start to implement a more logical way of organizing these schedules and creating great matchups in weeks 1, 2, and 3 that the consumer is really wanting and is really, really hoping for down the road. Spring practice continues to roll on, and the bunch of teams taken to the field this week to get their springs underway. Today, Boston College, UCF, Louisiana Monroe, and Western Kentucky will take the field. Tomorrow, you'll have FAU, FIU, Louisiana, Nevada, Old Dominion, Penn State, Temple, Utah, San Diego State, Tulane, and Arkansas State. On the 14th, you'll have Oregon, and on the 15th, you'll have Wisconsin and Virginia Tech. Let's dive into a couple of the teams in the Power Five that are very, very fascinating heading into this spring. A big question mark for each of these teams. How about we just dive in? All right. Penn State, the biggest question mark for me is Andy Kotelnicki is now running the offense. All right. Penn State, if you look at what Andy Kotelnicki's offense has looked like in the past, whether it be at Buffalo, whether it be at Kansas the last couple of years, very creative. They do a lot of intriguing things, some things that just don't really make sense, but they work. He does a really, really good job, and I think he's an extremely thoughtful offensive mind. And now he's going to try to blend in what he's done with the things that have worked in the past, with trying to keep as much of the same verbiage as possible. Now, if you hear that they're going to try to create the same verbiage, I think it's going to be a little tricky from time to time. But what does this mean for Drew Allard? It's now year 3. His second year as the starter, and the spotlight is going to be on him. His comfort, I think, is going to matter an awful lot. If you look, too, at what they have from a weapon standpoint, they've brought in Fleming. They've brought in some other pieces. Like, if you look at Penn State offensively, they should take a significant step forward this year offensively, but they got to create big plays, which was something that obviously plagued them at times last year. Let's go to Utah. Biggest question for them, who's going to emerge at safety? After Cole Bishop and Sione Vaki left for the NFL draft, Utah is replacing their two starters there in the back end. I think the spring will be very important in determining who is going to step into those spots. Now, Jonathan Hall, Alakai Gilman, Teo Johnson, all those guys are going to be vying for the position. You also have Nate Ritchie, who started alongside Jonathan Hall there in the Las Vegas Bowl. They could be the two that might have the first crack at it. But the safety spot is very important for Utah with how they style their defense, with how they set their defense up. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility of the senior Stanford transfer, Alakai Gilman, to be another possible option at the spot. He was all Pac-12 honorable mention last year, played in 9 games last season, started all 9, had 50 tackles, an interception, and 3 pass breakups. So keep an eye on the safety spot for Utah, because that is of the utmost importance. Perhaps one of the best teams in the country, the Oregon Ducks, will take the field a little later this week. I think they're a top 3, top 4 team in all of college football heading into 24. Now, What I've found in studying up for Oregon this offseason is that a lot of people are seemingly thinking that Dylan Gabriel and Dante Moore are going to be entrenched in the quarterback battle. Now, I don't know if that's the case. I look at what Dylan Gabriel did last year at Oklahoma, the year before at Oklahoma, and the yards that he's thrown for in his entire career, nearly 15,000 career passing yards. The fact that he has 49 career starts, I can't envision a scenario in which Dylan Gabriel isn't the starter. Seems to me it's going to be very difficult. It's a lot like when Bo Nix actually came to Oregon. There were some really bright moments for Bo when he was at Auburn, but there were some ups and downs. Well, with Gabriel, there haven't really been as many ups and downs. It's been mostly ups in his college career. So I fully anticipate him being the guy. But if you listen to people that are knowledgeable on what Dante Moore could be, is that yes, he played 9 games for UCLA last year, didn't do a great job from an efficiency standpoint, 11-9 touchdown to interception ratio, just over 50% completion. They kind of threw him into the deep end of the pool, though, and that was asking an awful lot of a freshman when you take into account what freshmen are usually kind of going through. There were just way too many ups and downs as a true freshman, but they feel like his development has been accelerated since he arrived in Eugene, and maybe he might be in a position to challenge Dylan Gabriel at the quarterback spot. I don't see it happening. I think the biggest thing for Oregon this spring season is to establish some depth on the defensive side, maybe find a second corner, maybe making sure that the edges of the defense, figuring out what the rotation is going to be there because they're very, very deep at defensive end. Like, I think there's a lot of priorities that I would address at Oregon before I worry about the quarterback competition, but it's sexy. I think it'll be Dylan Gabriel as QB1, Dante Moore as QB2, and then next year when Dylan Gabriel's eligibility is expired, it'll be Dante Moore's show moving forward. At Wisconsin, we know exactly where our eyes will be focused. That will be on Tyler Van Dyke. Now, he has transferred up from Miami. And if you think about what Tyler Van Dyke was at the end of last season, it was very different from that of what he experienced at the beginning of last season. There was a point last year, and you might call me crazy here, there was a point last year where Tyler Van Dyke was actually among the most efficient quarterbacks in college football. Now, it was just 3 or 4 games in, but the wheels came off against Georgia Tech and he could just never really find himself after that performance. But there was a time last year in the first month of the season that he was playing as well as anybody in the sport, albeit against some lower level competition, with the exception being Texas A&M, who he torched that day on the second week of the season. So Tyler Van Dyke now gets a fresh start. After the up and down time at Miami, a lot of people thought at one point he was going to be a first year starting quarterback in the NFL by now. Because if you look at his redshirt freshman season in 2021, when he threw for nearly 3,000 yards, about 9 yards per attempt, 25 touchdowns against just 6 interceptions, he just felt like, hey, the sky's the limit for this young man. Well, everything kind of regressed in 22 and 23, especially as it related to the decision-making and the turnovers that he had last year. Now, Luke Fickell decided to go the transfer route. They thought it could be Braden Locke, Nick Evers perhaps, but they decided to go the transfer route to bring in Tyler Van Dyke. So that 3-way quarterback competition will be interesting, but I expect it to be Van Dyke that locks down the position. He's way too talented. He just has to make better decisions. Simple as that. Has to make better decisions and understand what you can get away with without predetermining where you're going to go with the ball. Virginia Tech is next up, and the question is, can they continue to build on their late season offensive momentum? They're one of the top teams in the sport in terms of returning production, especially on the offensive side. 96% of the unit is back in 2024, including starting quarterback Kyren Drones, who became the go-to guy midseason. And kind of look at just how he performed in the bowl win over Tulane. Like, there's a lot to like about what this young man can do. He was excellent down the stretch, 10 touchdowns against just 1 interception in the final 4 games of the season. He threw he played really well in leading them to 3 victories in the final 4 games. Now, there are some times, too, where he really contributed an awful lot with his legs. A couple of those games goes for over 135 on the ground. So they have solid wide receivers on the perimeter. I think they're very, very solid at that spot. So if Drones can continue to accelerate his development, I think Virginia Tech's a bit of a dark horse this year and possible ACC championship contender, but their quarterback's progress is of the utmost importance. UCF, the big question for UCF is, can they take a big step defensively? Last year, they struggled to defend the run. They had some challenges at linebacker. Only four players last year really played any meaningful snaps. I mean, they really kind of, it was really Ryan Davis, Cam Moore, Walter Yates, who got a little beat up from time to time, and then Jason Johnson. Well, Davis, Johnson, and Yates have now graduated, meaning that they got to have a new defensive coordinator in Ted Roof that's going to come in and find some veterans at that position. So they went to the portal. They brought in Ethan Barr from Vanderbilt. He should be there in the middle of the defense. He was a captain at Vanderbilt the last couple of years, so he should be a plug-and-play guy there in the middle. Josiah Pierre also brings a lot of experience after having played at Texas Tech for multiple years. Then there's a few other guys that they're excited about, like Xri Alexander, who is transferring in from Idaho, who was named an FCS Freshman All-American last year. So it'll be really interesting, I think, to see the depth at linebacker and to see just how much they can progress on defense in the first year under Ted Roof. And then finally, the last team taking the field this week in the Power Five is Boston College. Can Bill O'Brien figure out how to take the potential of Thomas Castellanos and take him to the next level? Thomas Castellanos last year did some amazing things, all right? There were some things that were like, oh my goodness, this guy's unbelievable. And there were other times where it's like, you know, it's just not where it quite needs to be. I mean, completed just 57% of his passes, threw 14 interceptions, did have 15 touchdowns and over 1,100 rushing yards with 13 touchdowns. But you look at the rushing yards, which was, by the way, second only to Heisman Trophy winner Jaden Daniels, and you would like to just take a little bit more off of his legs and put a little bit more onto his arm. There were times he was running around, probably a little not necessarily always making great decisions as he was moving in the pocket. Well, in steps Bill O'Brien, who I think is excellent when it comes to quarterback development, and I think he's going to be able to kind of harness playmaking ability that Castellanos has and make him a more well-rounded player at the position, but that will start here in spring practice. Before we get out of here, there seems to be some growing buzz about the automatic buys that we talked about last week in expanding from the 12-team to the 14-team playoff, assuming it goes in that direction. The SEC and the Big Ten would be granted automatic buys. So it does sound like that conversation is starting to fizzle just a little bit, that there will be no automatic buys and it will be based on merit of what you accomplished that season that would get you to the number one or the number two overall spot. There also was a fascinating article that I thought was kind of a pulling back of the curtain about the financial distribution of the college football playoff and what it might look like. Ross Dellinger really did a great job in kind of breaking all of that down. So if you have an interest, it's not going to be something that we spend a lot of time on here, but if you have an interest, it is pretty fascinating. It really is. 58% of the college football revenue would go to the SEC and the Big Ten, so 29% each. 32% would go to the ACC and the Big 12, and the final 10% would be split between the G5 and Notre Dame. I don't know exactly what Notre Dame's portion would be, but if I'm them, I'm probably not real thrilled with my piece of the pie, at least as of right now. But either way, if you have an interest, check out Ross Dellinger. Check him out on Twitter. He has kind of all that stuff laid out, but we're not going to spend a lot of time on that today. Maybe at some point in the summer, we'll reevaluate those things, but speculation on what distributions would be in 2026 on the college football playoff is just not something that we're into right now. At least not right now. Not for me, but worth reading if you have an interest. That'll do it for us here at Always College Football. For all of us, Mark, Jake, Jack, I'm Greg. Please continue to like, rate, and subscribe to the show. It really helps us out. So please go, if you're on Apple Podcasts, if you're on Spotify, hit that thumbs up. rate, review, whatever. If you're on the ESPN YouTube channel, hit that thumbs up, leave a comment, ask questions too, because we want to start diving into our mailbag here at some point. So you can always follow us at AlwaysCFB, both on Instagram and on Twitter. So for all of us here at Always College Football, we continue to appreciate all of you so very much. Hope you have a terrific week, and remember, it's always college football. Hey guys, it's Greg McElroy. Thanks for watching Always College Football. Make sure you like, rate, and subscribe to ESPN's YouTube channel and wherever you listen to your podcasts.